open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
It takes me, with most of my books, probably 4 years or so to write. And I kind of say to myself, as I would in real life, do I really want to spend the next 4 years of my life with this person?
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author Richard Russo says creating art through writing is like watching a computer program buffer when it's stuck 99.7% of the way there.
And you think to yourself, well, we've come all this way. There's only just that little bit left to go. And you say, you can't come all this way and not finish. But that's the thing about art, is that you can actually go all that way and just continue to buffer.
Richard Russo's novels include Nobody's Fool and Empire Falls. His latest book is a collection of personal essays called The Destiny Thief. Richard talks this hour with actor and author Benjamin Bush. Benjamin asked Richard to explain how writers look at the world and translate it to the page.
Somewhere along the line, I learned that Flannery O'Connor, she used to like to get her students in creative writing, her fiction writers, she used to like to send them out with a sketch pad. She really wanted them to draw, and they didn't understand why. And of course, and she explained to them that the world, the fiction writer's world, is basically pretty humble, especially compared to what they thought it was, because they thought it was the world of ideas. And she wanted them to understand that the real world, the physical world, the world of the humble world that she was talking about, of physicality, of objects that register on the senses, she wanted them to understand that they were unlikely ever to get to the world of ideas if you weren't really very good at looking at the world right there in front of you. So she would force them to understand the primacy of observation by making them go out into the world and draw something. First of all, thank you for saying that or implying that I observe well, because it seems to me that's the part that I've had to work on hardest.
Really?
Because I've always thought that my ear is just so much better than my eye. I was writing this afternoon, actually, and because I was writing here on the road and writing in my notebook, my natural inclination is to take dictation from my characters, and sometimes I'll write 3 or 4 pages, and I'm usually writing badly when I do this, and then that part of me will say, slow down, see something, for heaven's sake. You've just been recording dialogue for a very long time, and it's one of the things that I've had to teach myself, is to slow down and see that physical world, which is so important, because it is the thing that's going to open up into something that we might think of as spiritual or some sort of truth that goes beyond the physical world. You can't just leap there. You have to go through that physical door. And for me too, as a writer, I also had to understand that I had to see what was important to me as opposed to what other people thought I should be looking at. And for most artists, to go back to the line that you quoted, Most especially young writers, emerging writers, have a tremendous sense of what's good or what other people think is good. And when you go into a writing program, there will be certain preferred authors that you're supposed to read, and they're always good writers. They're always great writers. But you have a sense of what other people want you to be. And when you read the work of William Trevor, say, or Alice Munro, both wonderful, wonderful writers, you're going to learn a lot from them. But one of the things also that you're going to learn is that may not be quite so healthy for you is that you kind of get the sense in the back of their mind that since they're so great, since they're such great writers, that what they observe naturally is what they look at twice is what you should be looking at twice. And that doesn't necessarily follow that just because they're great writers and interested in certain things, that what captures their attention, what they really observe, is something that, because they're great, you should be observing those same things. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah, you're talking more about also the emergence of voice.
Yes.
The things which drive your own particular and natural urges
right.
are unique to you, you hope. Or
yes.
else we'd all be looking at the same
yes.
things. And the hope of art
and
is
also,
to show
And
you.
Also unnatural urges.
Yeah, sure.
Especially.
Yeah. Some people take dictation from their characters.
Yeah.
Right? So there's medication for that.
Yeah, I know.
but the idea, of course, is that you hope that the artist is giving you something you don't notice. And forever after that, you hope also, in some ways, that they may notice those things because of the art they saw that you
yes.
gave them.
Yes.
And
yes.
those little notices also are what you find, I think, a juxtaposition is where your comedy comes from. This next to this is funny.
Right.
And you had a very serious argument, like dead serious.
Right.
Not funny argument
right.
about what's funny and what's not funny.
Right.
And, I mean, don't you win as soon as somebody laughs?
I think that,
all
yeah.
it takes is one person.
That's right. That's right. You can tell when something's funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Even if it's for the wrong reasons.
People. And, yep. Yep. And it's as a comic writer, you're always kind of swimming against that tide because there are just so many people out there. Especially, it just seems especially true now. There are just so many people out there that really want to tell you that something is not funny. You
yeah.
know, So the comic writer does have that extra heavy lift, I think, of trying to make people see something that they would just rather not see, because humor is so tied to the things that make us uncomfortable. It is and it's always been about sex and death and
farting.
Yeah.
That's always funny. It's not supposed to be funny, but it's always funny.
Every time. Although we won't test it here this evening.
I'm sorry, Richard. You don't know us very well. Welcome to Traverse City. But in that notice, the things we know are sometimes based on our experiences, right? Mm-hmm. As we begin to get a better understanding of the world, we get a better sense of context, and thus we have a richer sense for what's funny. Just because
yeah.
we know what that is.
Right.
And can you see in your own work how you were keying on different things and noticing different things as a younger writer than you are now that you know more? I'll rephrase.
Yeah, okay.
I'll use fewer vowels. What I mean is, when I was 14, there were things that were funny to me.
Right.
Which were usually inappropriate.
Right.
And I was told they
well,
were
Well, you were 14. Yeah.
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 Well, I haven't aged a lot
yeah.
in some respects. But you know, my daughter came up to me one time. You know, my wife and I were talking. Of course, I said something which a 14-year-old man who's almost 50 would say. And my daughter
yeah.
said, "Dada, that's inappropriate."
Right.
And I was like, oh, we've already trained her not to enjoy that funniness.
Yes.
That's yeah. the cruelty of society.
Yeah.
She was right.
Yeah.
But it was funny.
But it was funny. That's right. That's right.
And that's kind of what a lot of your essays get at, is that I guess Manichaean is your go-to, that we're born into the duality of having the dark and the light, and then they're
yep.
not entirely in conflict. They're just together. They cohabitate.
Right.
And to refuse one is maybe a problem.
Well, the Manichaean nature, I think, of my younger years was probably that I had my father was just a natural bull****er.
Mm.
And he and my mother separated when I was fairly young. So there was that when I was around him, which wasn't all that often, there was that buoyant sense of someone who is absolutely inappropriate, frequently hilarious. And then on the other side, being raised Catholic.
Where everything is wrong.
Where everything is wrong and nothing is funny.
Yeah.
So I think of the difficulty that I had as a young writer is probably traceable back to that conflict in my life, which was that yes, things are serious, but they're also funny. But for a very long time, my maternal grandmother was one of these people who looked forward to holy days. Some of the rest of you had, we all had that grandmother. And she didn't even call them holy days. She would call them holy days of obligation, right? You never leave off the obligation, do you, right? No. They were holy days of obligation. And as soon as you had fulfilled your obligation on this day, you would hear about the next one so that you knew that.
Right. So there would be no joy eventually.
You've having completed one obligation, you would begin to look forward to the next one, which of course would involve sacrifice of some sort.
Right.
So if you weren't sacrificing,
you got to live in hell before you got there.
Exactly, in the full knowledge that it was not going to get better, it was going to get worse. And then of course the nuns, those savage. Nuns that I had in high school, they tried their best to impress upon us the seriousness of the world, and of course we were having none of it, but they tried so hard to wipe a lot of that that one particular way of looking at the world. It's not by coincidence that the word fool appears in the titles of two of my novels, and I felt a natural affinity for that, but for so long in my young life, the forces trying to just scrape that out of me, you know, with a claw hammer, were in the ascendant, and even you know, much later when I was trying to learn how to be a writer in graduate school, I think that was still working on me in some way, because my first impulse was to be not just a serious writer, but far more important than that, to be taken seriously. And how do you do that if you're a jokester? If you just do see the human condition as and our striving in life to have just a little dignity that life doesn't seem to want to allow us, you know? And yeah, it took me a long time to hear my father's voice, which I was deprived of a lot when I was young. So that's where that Manichaean, that sense of whether we're talking about light and dark or good and evil, those two perfectly poised opposing forces, they weren't perfectly poised when I was growing up.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you talk about religion professor who finds a moment of joy listening to Grace Slick, and then afterwards has her epiphany that all she ever wanted to do was sing rock.
Right.
And of course you were attracted while under the stewardship of nuns to rock, and I always thought that to get closer to God, you have to rock. It's the way and the light.
It has something to do with volume too.
Volume as well.
yeah.
Skill,
yeah.
Not as much.
Yeah.
But you were and you said you kind of hear more than you.
Yeah.
Than you see in the writing and the noticing.
Interesting too, because
you're
I did play my rock and roll at a very high volume. So it's interesting that I hear anything anymore.
Yeah.
But. And maybe it's that I hear only things that don't exist, having destroyed my actual ears. now I only hear what isn't there.
You still hear Bruce.
I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
But you also talk about that urge.
Yeah.
That suddenly being presented something which seems transporting.
Right.
And I was seeing a rock band play.
Right.
Good or bad as they were something unworldly.
And, absolutely.
And it was that sudden sense of, I don't know what that is, but what it is, I want. And
yeah.
That drove you to buy, you know, cheap guitars and cheap amps and borrow
right.
things and make a band. And at some point, and you talk about this, it's a terrifying line, but you write, but hunger remembered is not the same as hunger felt.
Right.
And I guess we talk about the youthful urges you have, and over time, how some of them thin out or are taught out or just
right.
don't seem to be possible.
Right.
What was it that turned you away from music and eventually turned you into a different kind of experience as a storyteller? Because, you know, music is storytelling, even if it's bad.
And storytelling like Springsteen does is
usually pretty good.
Yeah.
I listened to Rat, which was not the best kind of storytelling, but it had more energy than, you know, nuclear power.
So. Yeah, exactly. There were two transitions that kind of redefined hunger a little bit. The first, before I heard that first live rock and roll band, which made me levitate, before that, the hunger that I felt in my life was a hunger for an intact family, because my I want to preface this by saying I had a wonderful family. My parents separated when I was young, but I had an aunt and uncle just down the street and their kids, so I didn't suffer for love, and we lived, my mother and I, after my parents separated, above my grandparents, who were doting grandparents. So I had more love probably than any one kid deserves, taken all things taken into consideration. But my father left at a particularly awkward time for me, because I didn't understand it, and I thought that maybe I was to blame.
Yeah.
I didn't see any other particular reason for it. If not me, then what? And when he left, I spent and it also was a small town. People didn't divorce, and so I had a hunger for an intact family. And not even so much that I wanted an intact family, is that I just didn't want to be different anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time yearning and hungering for that intact family. And what rock and roll did, or at least rock and roll played at a very high volume, what that did was substitute one hunger for another. It allowed me not to be hungry in one way, because this other hunger was so, it was absolutely, as you describe it, it's absolutely visceral. I must have this. It doesn't have anything to do with can I, or should I, or any of those other consideration. You just must do it. And I love music still, but I think what happened there, because so long when I played in these rock and roll bands coming from a poor family, we just didn't have very good equipment. And one of the easiest things when you're trying to get good at anything, one of the easiest lies to tell yourself is that I would be just so much better if I had good equipment. Right.
Which is hard for the writer, because once you have a pen, better paper.
Yeah. But what happened was that sometime in my 20s, I somehow or other saved up enough money from various jobs to buy a wonderful Gibson 12-string.
With pearl inlay.
And I played it. I played it faithfully for years and years and years. And I had a gig in Tucson where I sang at a restaurant. I had a gig that lasted like 5, 6, 7 years, playing Friday and Saturday nights in this place. And I was decent. But I think there came a point when I realized that I was never going to have much better equipment than the equipment that I was playing on. And there was nothing else to blame, really. But I knew that I had kind of, I had peaked. I was never going to get really good. And so the moment the hunger disappeared, I think, at that moment when I realized that I was as good as I was ever going to be, and the equipment, I couldn't blame the equipment anymore. And almost again, what's interesting about this is that the transference was made so quickly, almost to the moment that I recognized I was never going to be as good as I wanted to be and needed to be, I discovered writing like almost the next day. And to me, that's what's interesting about it is that I just might be the kind of person who has to be hungry. You know, that there's something in my nature that sense of must is somehow part of me. I don't know what to make of it, but I know that there was almost no time between the moment when I was hungry for an intact family, and which was supplanted by rock and roll, and then when rock and roll and singing was supplanted by writing. There's just almost no, the window couldn't have been open for more than a few hours.
Over the years, and you've been accused of being a comic writer because you're a comic writer.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, you say in here that, you know, it comes, that you realized it was kind of your natural urge, that there was a compulsion on some level to share your observations that you made along
right.
the way.
Right.
I guess the question is, you know, how did you begin to make those decisions, you know, choose to write in a way which, I guess, felt most natural to your urges? When did you get past the point where you felt that there was inhibition to that?
Right. Well, failure has a lot to do with it. Was it Winston Churchill? One of the Brits always said that you can always count on America to do the right thing after they've exhausted all other options. And I think for me, I had exhausted all my other options, because I did try to be a much more serious writer and to try to be taken seriously, and it clearly just was not working. I was getting better with my tools. You know, every story that I wrote would be technically better because I was, it's like anything else that you do, and you do it often enough, you get better at it. You get better at it in that kind of technical way. But it felt to me like I wasn't really getting any closer to finding a voice. And I wasn't getting any closer to discovering who I was. I tried to be Raymond Chandler, and I tried to be Ross McDonald, and I tried to be everybody. I tried to be J.D. Salinger. I tried to all of the writers that I admired. I tried to be. It just wasn't working. You know?
Which is interesting, because when you were younger, you just didn't want to be different.
Right.
And then the artist's only job
is to be different.
Exactly, to be different.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was that small piece of writing that you did. It was mostly about kind of the hometown area of Gloversville, Johnson. That someone said, you know, this sounds like real unique writing.
Yeah.
And you, of course, like we all do, immediately disbelieved it. Until you
I not only disbelieved it, I was angry. I was really angry, because when I left this mill town that I've been writing about pretty much my whole career, every now and then I get off that reservation for a while, but I seem to be pulled back. To me, going to the university, as I told, and there's a short essay in this book, not an essay really, it was the commencement address I gave at Colby College the year my daughter graduated from there. I viewed education as pretty much like entering the witness protection program. I wanted nobody to recognize me as this kid from this mill town.
You've done a terrible job.
Well, I know. but for a while, the thing is that for a while I thought I was doing a good job. I did a BA, and then I did an MA in literature and a PhD in literature, and people didn't seem to think that, you know, once I finished my dissertation that anything would be terribly wrong with me being an English professor for the rest of my life, which meant that I had fooled at least those people into thinking that I was just, my natural affinity was the life of the mind in the world of ideas. And so as soon as I got that, as soon as I finished my dissertation and got that slip of paper, I was going forward, I thought, into a world of scholarship. So that was going to be my diploma from the Witness Protection Program, right? Here was this completely different person, unrecognizable as the kid from the mill town. And then when I decided I wanted to be a writer, I wrote a lot of stories, but then I wrote this novel and gave it to my mentor. And he read the whole thing dutifully, 350 pages worth of really not good at all fiction. And he gave it back to me and said that basically, you know, it's not very good. I already knew that. I was hoping he would tell me something different, but then he said, except for this one short section of about 40 pages that set place in this mill town in upstate New York. Because what he was really telling me, of course, that all those years in the Witness Protection Program had been for nothing. He had seen through the disguise.
They found you.
Right away, they found me. I hadn't gone far enough.
And isn't a little encouragement as dangerous to a writer as despair?
I have to think about that.
Because you talk.
Yeah, but I think they're linked. Actually, that little encouragement and despair.
Exactly.
You just go. You just go from the other. It's a luge ride from there. from a little encouragement. It's a luge ride. all the way down to the bottom.
Yeah, yeah. No one ever luges up.
Yeah.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Richard Russo talks about screenwriting and the film adaptation of his book, Nobody's Fool.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Benjamin Bush's conversation with author Richard Russo.
You write in here, and I, you know, cross this to pass on to many a student in the future, I'm sure. Indeed, a good hint that you've entered the realm of art is that you immediately feel like giving up. You become overwhelmed by the astonishing complexity of the task, the sheer number of moving parts over which you have less than perfect control, the perversity of happenstance, the impossibility of predicting outcomes.
Right.
And that's, it's all dangerous territory. You know,
yes.
As my father wrote, the dangerous profession. How do you then begin to talk, and you also talk about in this book the idea, the importance after having seen an oral surgeon kind of show how he's going to map out fixing a mess of teeth.
Yeah.
You talk about sequence, the importance of sequence, the necessity
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
In building your stories, do they come to you in pieces, broken asteroids, or do you...
Tiny pieces, unrelated pieces. Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do you begin to sew them?
And actually, to go back to the quote that you just gave, and thank you for the reading of that particular quotation, because I think it is important. I think that those all of those things, the difficulty of it, how many moving parts there are, having less than perfect control over all of those moving parts, all of that that makes you want to quit is actually the good news. Because it's the thing that keeps you from ever being smug. It's the thing that keeps you from feeling like you've mastered something. And it's what keeps you, to go back to the metaphor of hunger, is what keeps you going back with that same kind of thrill, but also that same sense of danger and the voice in your head saying, all right, this time you finally figured out something that there is no solution for. Here you finally found, congratulations on finally locating the book that you can't write.
Yeah.
All of that anxiety that you had in writing your first novel is all there, but because all of that is there, the hunger is still there too. So the good news and the bad news are kind of wrapped up in that same package.
Manichaean.
Yeah, Manichaean again. Yeah, yeah. You know, and funny how that comes back. Phrase comes back, mixing memory with desire.
We're all elliptical. And back to hunger, you also write, hunger has no business preceding ability, but it always does, with no exception.
Yeah.
And it's back to those urges. As you compose, and I think, you know, the artist always worries that, you know, the reason we keep working is that we fear always that we can't do better. We can't improve on something we've already completed. And even
right.
That's a failure of sorts on second look.
Right.
And on later years and,
right.
and better ability. You talk a lot about the difference between craft and art, their linkage, but also their difference. The idea that you can be a competent sentence maker
right.
and not a good writer
right.
in the full sense of things is right. interesting. Because,
right.
You know, the first thing we try to teach in any kind of program is, okay, well, make your sentences good first.
Right, right.
And then you stack them in this sequence.
Right.
And that's how narratives happen. And then you populate them with people who make a certain sense for
mm-hmm.
an arc.
Mm-hmm.
And then you finally get good at that stuff. And if you don't have something unique, if the characters aren't speaking to you while you're driving and everything else,
right.
like many writers who have the full urge to write,
yeah.
They're still not good.
Right.
It still doesn't work. How do you, both with young writers, talk about the fact that we can't avoid imitation because of all the influences out there.
Right.
We read something, we go, oh, that's good, I should do that.
Right.
And you were talking about that earlier, but you can't.
Right.
That's theirs.
Right.
And how do you talk about finding that space, that small mill town that was hiding in your novel, which ended up being the book Mohawk in the end, which was your first kind of strike and hit.
Yeah. Well, Ann Patchett, who I know was here fairly recently and talked a little bit about this too, and in her great essay about the making of a writer, the making of her as a writer, says, I think, quite astutely that craft comes first because it kind of has to. Art is, she says, art stands on the shoulders of craft. And so you first, you know, no matter what kind of artist you are, not just writers, but if you're a painter or whatever, somebody has to teach you what the tools are for, and you have to learn how to hold them, and you can get better. And what's so frustrating about it is that you can make so much progress. It's as if on a continuum, you know you have to go from here to here, right? And craft, what's so frustrating about it is that craft can get you from here all the way over to there. And in a sense, and you look at that, you know, it's like we do with our devices, you know, and you update your operating system and you watch the little thing go all the way across the screen. And sometimes it gets almost to the end and then something happens and the thing continues to circle.
Yeah.
You continue to buffer, right there, and you look at it and you think, I'm 99, and it tells you right below that, you are 99.7% of the way there. And you think to yourself, well, we've come all this way, there's only just that little bit left to go, and you say, finish, for God's sake. You can't come all this way and not finish. But that's the thing about art, is that you can actually go all that way and just continue to buffer. Yeah. But it's helpful for emerging writers and for young writers to realize that even though that can be kind of discouraging, and you think, my God, I've put in all this time. I've written my 1,000 pages of bad prose. I've made all the sacrifices. I've been as faithful as I can to the work and to the craft, and look at all the sacrifices that I have made, and I continue to buffer right there, you know, with 0.3% to go. And that can be very discouraging. But in my case, once I did find that, and I didn't find something, I found me, in a sense. What I found was, I found a version of Richard Russo that was going to be a writer. And really, that's a much simpler question, and that's, who is that person? It's a question of, for me, it was a question of finding out who and what I loved, which I had been running away from for a long time. But once I found that, the buffer went off and went ping, just like that. And that's, the good news is that once you find that, you're never going to have to find it again. You're never going to forget that. Which doesn't mean that every book that you write is going to be as good as the last book. And there will be times when you lose sight of certain things. But who and what you love, once you figure it out, is unlikely to change. At least in any really significant way.
And, you know, we, as readers, when we see a story, it's already been milled. You've been through it yourself until, you have forehead stress fractures, and your editor's been through there, the arguments that have ensued over word choices and everything else. We see it as a pure piece of work without any of the struggles inherent to its creation. How do you know when it's there? How do you know when it's time to stop? Like, okay, it does everything I want it to. Because, you know, of course, the wheel can continue. You can be on 99.5. And we'll never know how much time was spent in that room. Are you someone who, like, are you an organized writer, or do you write like I do, out of a debris field of just wreckage?
Yes, the second.
That's good.
Put her there, brother. There are a number of things that occur to me about knowing when to stop. One of the things that will happen to me is that I will recognize, or some objective part that's disassociated, some part of my brain that's disassociated from anxiety, which is a small part, will realize that I'm making things worse. Right, sometimes, and that's hard, especially for a comic writer, because all jokes get stale, and you can revise and revise and revise, and sometimes you think, this isn't funny anymore, and it never was, and it was, but you're just tired of it. You've been working on it too long. But if you find yourself working on something that's actually getting worse, and sometimes you can tell that it is, then it's a good time to stop. In the sense of, are we ever really stopped? I have had, on occasion, opportunities to revisit old work of mine because I've been asked to write the screenplay.
Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing, because now, you know, you have to read it in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
In terms of actual creative time. All of the visual material is fabricated, the lines remain. Which ones do you choose? And how do you do that?
Viciously, ruthlessly.
I like both of those words.
Yeah, yeah. And it's hard. It's hard to do.
Because you did Empire Falls,
yep.
Which was purely your adaptation.
That was my adaptation. And I have to say, Ben, when I look back on that HBO miniseries, I look at it with great pride, but it's pride in almost every aspect of the thing except my screenplay, because those actors brought such life to those roles, and I don't know if we're ever going to have another miniseries that would be able to attract a cast like that for the amount of money that they spent on it.
It was Paul Newman's last appearance on film.
That's right, and my feeling was that they needed a fresh set of eyes to write the screenplay, because if you look at it, I solved the screen problems pretty much the way I solved the novel problems. And if you were to compare that to a movie like The Ice Harvest, which I adapted from another writer's novel, I think that what I brought to that project was exactly that, a fresh set of eyes. And so when I read Scott Phillips' book, which I loved, by the way, I thought it was a terrific novel, and I really wanted to write the screenplay for that badly. But when I looked at the novel and started to think, well, all right, here's this pretty good sized chunk of book, and we're only going to have, it's a thriller, so we're not going to be going much over 90 minutes. So we're talking 90 to 95 pages. How do we do that? And I saw two characters in the novel. They were both wonderful characters and vivid characters. But when you looked at the structure of it, you realized they were helping the plot to get to the same place. In other words, they served the same dramatic function. And the first thing I did was say, all right, we're going to combine those characters. And the thought that was in the back of my mind is, what in the world is Scott Phillips going to think when he sees that I have taken two vivid characters and combined their function? But that's what I mean about ruthlessness and fresh eyes.
Yeah.
Is that was something I was able to see about that movie and that novel because I wasn't invested in the decision making that was inherent in writing the novel. Mm-hmm. And it's what I missed about Empire Falls that I think if you haven't seen it and you see it, or if you see it again, listen to the voiceover in that. The voiceover was necessary. But there shouldn't have been nearly that much of it. And when you have, would you agree that when you have voiceover in a movie, very often it indicates trouble?
I don't want to.
That certain things are not clear that should be clear in their own.
I don't want to condemn you.
Right, yeah.
Next to you.
But, yeah. Yeah.
But voiceover is dangerous because it means it has to compensate for something.
Something that's not there.
And normally with a novel, you can see why everyone feels it necessary because so much of that of a novel is interior space, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know things because we're in the character's head. How do you do that on film other than he glances and looks mournful now?
Right.
That has to summate an entirely, huge.
And a novel like Empire Falls gets experienced over a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, whereas
it would be like trying to do that with
the miniseries is going to be an experience of 3 hours,
right?
3.5 hours.
And Bridge of Sighs would be just as painful
yes.
to try.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
And that's interesting because you've also you've written straight up. A few films as well, and that's a different kind of writing, and also at the same time, you're still dealing with the same narrative problems. How did you approach just writing a screenplay that didn't proceed from another work?
Right. Well, I've done that a couple of times. One was a movie called Twilight that Robert Benton and I did right after the success of Nobody's Fool.
Which, if you haven't seen Nobody's Fool, it's a beautiful, sweet,
yeah, absolutely.
Great film.
And it really holds up, I think. And I say that, and I didn't make the movie. Robert Benton made the movie, but yeah, it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking, I think.
Comes out of a good book.
But Twilight, you think?
You said it's better if you read the book first.
Yeah.
I agree.
The movie Twilight had additional things going on with it because it was a detective movie. And when Benton and I wrote it, we had both studied a lot of, we went back and looked at a lot of old tough guy detective movies, The Big Sleep, Farewell My Lovely, all the classics. And then we started writing the movie. And Benton is a very character-oriented director. I'm a very character-oriented writer. And you only have about 90 or 95 pages. And I remember we got a little over halfway there, really enjoying ourselves, enjoying the characters. We had three, four really, really good characters in it to follow. And at some point around page 50 or 55, Benton said to me, all right, who did this anyway? Who committed this murder? And I said, I thought you knew. And so we had to do something we had never done before, and all the narratives that we had built around vivid characters, we had to go back and just start at the very end of the movie and say, all right, who did it? We decided that, and then we worked backwards, which is something that neither of us had ever done before. A movie called Keeping Mum,
right,
was an original screenplay that I wrote. It was supposed to be set in America, but the producers were British, and they just set it in the UK, but a lot of the rest of it was exactly as I had written it.
All the S, all the Z's are pronounced in, as S's. In
yeah, and there are a lot more U's in words like color. Just listen for it when you see them.
You can tell.
And when I wrote that, one of the things that screenwriting taught me was that it's really helpful, certainly for screen, but also for novel writing, to think of structure perhaps a little earlier than I had ever done as a novelist. And so to think of a movie like Keeping Mum, which I do recommend to you, it's wicked, wicked, wicked fun. To think about something in terms of three acts, where the first act is going to be 20 or 25 pages, and at the end of that you have to sense that something, there's been a huge shift. You thought that there was $5 in the pot, now suddenly there's $100 in the pot. The stakes have just gotten so much bigger and you didn't see it coming. Then there's that long middle of a movie that will extend, you know, if it's 90 pages, the middle section, if the first section was 20 or 25 pages, the middle section is going to be most of the rest, and the third act will be, you know, the race for the finish, and it will be 15 or 20 pages. Thinking in terms of that structure was very, very helpful to me as a writer with several novels under my belt, but just making my first forays into screenwriting, thinking of stories as being paced that way and of having those kinds of very broad lines of demarcation was enormously helpful to me in writing screenplays, and I discovered that coming back to writing novels afterwards, it was enormously helpful too to be thinking about structure earlier in the process.
Do you find that blocking into that consideration of structure can also mess up the possibilities that a story can have by thinking, like worrying about sequence early, worrying about structure early? Can that interfere with what might organically come out of chaos?
But you know what? So many things can go wrong with a movie. Yeah. Never mind. Well, our part in it is so small. And we also have the blessing, too, of when it does come out completely botched,
we have a lot of people to blame.
We very seldom get blamed. there are other people who are going to take the fall.
I wrote, produced, and directed one of my films, so I had nowhere to go.
No, you certainly didn't you?
Wait a minute.
Are you ever going to do that again?
Sure.
Yeah.
You got any money?
Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it?
There you go. Yeah. And I love, you know, certain lines like from Nobody's Fool, where Tandy comes out and says, you know, doesn't it bother you that you haven't done more with the life God gave you?
Yeah.
And then you know, Paul Newman says, not often.
Yeah.
Now and then.
Now and then. Yeah.
Do you feel that that really preserved the feeling of your book?
Yeah. I've talked with people about that movie many times, and they always say something to me that is both that on the one hand makes me smile, and yet on the other hand I'm always nodding in agreement when they say it. And they say that that the thing that they love most about the movie of Nobody's Fool was how faithful it was to the book. And the reason that makes me smile is that, of course, Benton, who wrote the screenplay, cut out about 3/4 of the novel.
Exactly. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. And what makes me nod in agreement is lines exactly like the one that you just quoted, because what he was faithful to was not the novel. What he was faithful to was the spirit of the novel, right, and the spirit of its main character. And so what was left out of it, I've just never seen a more perfect representation of a novel that's simply now living in a completely different medium.
Hmm. Yeah. And you talk about, you know, what matters a lot. You're like, what truly matters? Like, why do you? And I talk about this with students as well. You know, if you're writing a story and it doesn't matter, what's right, the necessity of it, right, to anyone, including yourself? Is it just, you know, is it just something that you are capable of doing? And you talk about your grandfather, who right, spent his whole life becoming a master craftsman at choosing the right spot to cut, you know, leather for gloves.
Right.
And it was an art as well as a craft.
Yeah.
His choices were more than something a machine could do.
Right.
And at a certain point, he was run out of that art. That guild ended.
Right.
Machinery took over, and eventually people stopped noticing blemishes on gloves. They just
right,
said, oh, well.
Right.
It didn't matter anymore. And you write in here, unfortunately, I had enough of my grandfather in me to share this dilemma. How do you learn not to care about something that matters?
Right.
And it seems like you impart this into your characters, too. It seems like many times the conflict is over what matters.
Right.
Who do you love? Why do you love them? These urges that you need to follow. Mm-hmm. When you're creating a character, when someone's beginning to speak to you, and you're taking dictation, how do you know that person's worth bringing into the world? How do you know someone's worth giving birth to?
Well, that's just such.
You're just surrounded by embryos.
That is just such a good question. I don't know if it'll be entirely disappointing or not to just tell you, I don't know. I honestly don't. It's a feeling. And it's a feeling that transcends, will this person be useful in the end? Because when you're at the beginning, you don't know what the end is, so how could you possibly know whether the character would be of any use to you?
Is not understanding someone the most interesting thing?
It might be the most interesting thing about it. I mean, you have to know something in order to have a clue whether this person will be interesting or not. I mean, part of it might come down to just something like kind of artistic selfishness, in the sense that it takes me, with most of my books, probably 4 years or so to write. Mm-hmm. And I kind of say to myself, as I would in real life, do I really want to spend the next 4 years of my life with this person? And I probably use a lot of the same criteria. What causes me to, you know, walk away from a conversation in real life is because I just have this feeling it's not going anywhere, and I'm not having fun.
Yeah.
And so.
Except when you're sitting here, it'd be just really rude to leave. But you know, you also write, I mean, this whole thing is the destiny thief,
right,
and it talks about kind of the sense of you know, progression that any of us have. Like, at some point, you know, we all have an arc. And you say, I've written a lot about destiny in my fiction, not because I understand it, but because I'd like to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, kind of questioning, isn't that what we, you know, what faith is? Isn't that what so many of these other things we don't consider related to writing really are?
Right.
It's just a narrative in a sense. and impulses and hungers.
Right.
And I think that's what you do.
Yeah, and again, if you're trying to test these characters out and these themes out, one of the best ways to know, I suppose, whether it's worth it or not is that profound sense of mystery. Because if you were to compare my work, for instance, with the work of, say, Jane Smiley.
She moves around
Jane,
a lot.
Jane Smiley is a wonderful writer. I love her work, and one of the things that I love about it is that when I pick up a new book of hers, the question that's always in my mind is, all right, what's Jane up to now? Because her books are so different, and she's really interested in everything. I mean, she's just interested in life in general. She's not interested in one particular kind of person or one particular kind of event. Early on in her career, she said she wanted to write one of everything, just every kind of book that there was. Interesting that one of her earlier books was an Icelandic saga. And if you say you're going to write one of everything, and one of them is an Icelandic saga, you better hope to live a long time too if you're going to get to the end. But with Jane, that's what Jane's great curiosity is what pulls people into her work. I mean, she's interested in everything. Whereas I think of my own work is that I have an incredibly narrow bandwidth. I'm really only interested in two or three things, but there are two or three things that I can't quite seem to get to the bottom of. Hmm. That the more I go back, each book teaches me, you know, I get somewhere, the journey has gone somewhere, and I'm always happy to have taken the journey. And I like to think that people who take the journey with me feel like the journey has gone somewhere and you've gotten something out of it. But each book has taught me what I don't know about the next one. And so despite the fact that I'm far less curious a writer than someone like Jane Smiley, and I do have that incredibly narrow bandwidth, it's the fact that I can't get to the bottom of any of this stuff, these obsessions, these hungers that we've been talking about really right from the beginning of this discussion. The fact that whatever it is whatever is eating at me, I can't seem to get to the bottom of, which keeps me coming back. And again, it's one of those good news, bad news things. It's like Dickens with his orphans, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just never getting adopted.
That's right.
You know, I could ask many questions. I'm inquisitive. But since we just got you out of witness protection, you can only imagine how much I'm interested. You know, and you're right, I figured the more I actually knew, the less I'd have to pretend to know. And I think that's one of those interesting things about pursuing more information and getting a better sense of the world that writing does.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Richard Russo talking with Benjamin Bush. Richard Russo's latest book is The Destiny Thief. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockandpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.